This interview is being conducted with Captain D.K. Hanna by Gunnery Sergeant Alan B. Richardson at Marine Corps Schools, Quantico, Virginia. The subject of the interview is fixed-wing aircraft operations in the Vietnam area, and it is in unclassified. Captain, would you state your name, grade, and service number, please?
Yes, Don K. Hanna, Captain, 072105.
What were your duty assignments while you were in Vietnam?
I was an intelligence officer and an additional duty of an F-4B Phantom pilot.
What period did you serve in these billets, and where were you physically located within Vietnam during the period covered?
I served for a total of 2 years in these billets, but during the period covered by the interview was in Vietnam from 10 April to the 6th of June, 1965.
Would you discuss any major combat actions, battalion size or larger, in which you participated, giving the dates, location, and purpose of the operation?
Yes, I'd like to cover a couple of items that really wouldn't be battalion or larger size, but were rather significant from the point of view of Marine aviation as I go down through, and I have a small list here. The first one would be the first excursion into North Vietnam by Marine fixed-wing aviation, which occurred on the 6th of May, 1965, and this was a rescue combat air patrol to the vicinity of Vinh Linh Army Barracks, so the central and northeast in North Vietnam, and was for the purpose of providing rest cap for an RF-101 pilot who had been shot down. This flight was conducted by a pair of F-4Bs and succeeded in destroying a 37mm AAA sight and portion of a flak tower. This was the one and only excursion by VMFA 531 into North Vietnam. Then on 14th of May, a rather significant action occurred in which involved U.S. Marine ground personnel, and this was a scramble to provide close air support for two trapped U.S. Marine combat patrols from Delta Company, 3rd Recon Battalion, 3rd Marine Division, and this was in the vicinity of Nam Yen, about 12 miles northeast of Da Nang. Two combat patrols had been attempting to flush out the Viet Cong and had gone into a valley which was later discovered to be completely encircled by hardcore VC and dug-in positions. And without the use of a forward air controller or any means of communicating with the troops in these two patrols, using an Army helicopter to radio relay instructions, a flight of three F-4Bs provided close air support for the two patrols and successfully were able to get them evacuated out of the area. The initial request for these fixed-wing support aircraft came due to the fact that the rescue helicopter going in to pick up the wounded and KIAs of this patrol had been rather badly shot up and had to withdraw without accomplishing his mission. This was the first significant case of close air support for U.S. Marines on the ground in the Da Nang area, and took place on the 14th of May, 1965. Then on the 27th of May, we had the first occasion for Marine fixed-wing aircraft to provide helicopter escort and landing zone preparation for the largest force ever assembled in one point in I Corps for the purpose of conducting an assault and a search-and-clear operation in the Da Nang area. And this was a 3rd Battalion of Arvin Marines with a battalion of Arvin troops, comprised of two Marine helicopter squadrons, HMM-163 and HMM-161, in addition to portions of an Arvin helicopter squadron and Marine fixed-wing air in the person of F-4B Phantoms. Now, this was conducted about 7 miles to the southwest of the Da Nang Air Base and resulted in complete neutralization of the landing zone areas, with 11 structures destroyed, 6 damaged, 2 secondary explosions, and was the first attempt by Marine fixed-wing aircraft, jet aircraft in combat, to lay down a last-minute barrage of the landing zones using rockets just prior to the helicopter touchdown. And as attested to by the commanding officer of HMM-163, Colonel Ewers, proved most effective. From this date on, the 27th of May, HMM-163 received no further ground fire or damage to aircraft or aircrew from VC activity due to the close support they were receiving from fixed-wing jet aircraft. On the 28th of May, the day following, there was another helicopter escort landing zone preparation flight this time conducted some 180 miles southeast of Da Nang, in the vicinity of the Gia Vuc outpost, and this was a one-battalion Arvin troop and special forces lift into extremely mountainous terrain to attempt to pin down several companies of Main Corps VC. And this helicopter lift was preceded by a one-and-a-half-hour pre-strike and interdiction of targets in the area by Marine F-4Bs, and again a last-minute rocket barrage delivered in simultaneous landing zones, three simultaneous and adjacent landing zones, prior to the first helicopter touching down. And the timing that was being tried for on these barrages was 10 seconds prior to the first helicopter touching down in the LZ. There was to be a barrage delivered, four 19-shot rocket pods by an F-4B coming right over the head of the lead helicopter into the terrain surrounding the landing zones, providing a neutralization fire. The next major or significant action I'd like to talk about is the Battle for Quang Nai and Quang Nai Province. This occurred on the 28th of May through the 6th of June, 1965, and this is a major battle in I Corps area, which is credited, which the commanding general, Arvin I Corps, credits fixed-wing aircraft, both Marine and Air Force, with the saving of Quang Nai City and Quang Nai Province. And in fact, by positive body count, there were over 600 KBA VC credited to air power alone. And this was a battle involving some 6,500 North Vietnamese regulars and main force Viet Cong conducting heavy night operations attempting to eliminate Quang Nai City and the major friendly elements of Quang Nai Province. This operation was the first introduction of VMFA 531 into night strikes using paraflare illumination, and this was conducted with Air Force C-130 aircraft dropping paraflares in strings of 15 or 16 flares at a time, allowing uninterrupted light over the target for Marine Phantoms to conduct close air support of Arvin troops and Special Forces personnel in beleaguered outposts.
How about helicopter operations in the area, Captain?
Right. Helicopter operations, as I mentioned in the previous two cases, VMFA 531 flying the F-4B Phantom was the first jet squadron to escort Marine helicopters in combat and deliver landing zone preparation strikes in the Republic of Vietnam. And this first incident occurred on the 28th of April, 1965. The tactics devised were basically a three-plane flight with a criteria of one aircraft being able, in that flight, being able to attack any position around the helicopters within 15 seconds of the helicopters being fired upon. In addition, the tremendous noise level created by the F-4B jets was planned to be utilized to keep Viet Cong heads down in the landing zone, and for this purpose, the F-4Bs used a Lufbery-type pattern with one F-4B going by the lead helicopter and below him, right on the deck at high speed, 400 to 500 knots, pulling up in front of the lead helicopter in a tight G-turn, and all three aircraft continuing this pattern around the lead helicopter, alternating each side of him. This covered a considerable amount of territory and was definitely credited by Huey Fang pilots with keeping the lead down as far as the VCs were concerned. VMFA 531 flew a total of 159 helo escort and landing zone preparation sorties in all types of terrain and weather throughout I Corps and II Corps, South Vietnam. Some of the difficulties encountered in this helicopter escort, which has been practiced previously only by A-4-type aircraft and not in combat as yet, with the exception of this 531 incident, some of the difficulties encountered were keeping the helicopters in sight due to their green color and the green jungle terrain. This was somewhat alleviated by painting one of the rotor blades, the top of one of the rotor blades, with a white paint, which made it relatively easy to spot them in the with a dark green background. In addition, it requires that the helicopters, especially in large formations, when you've got 60 to 80 helicopters in one formation, requires that they maintain an extremely good and tight formation and warn the escorting aircraft when they intend to change direction if it's not a pre-planned change in the flight path. As you can imagine, attempting to provide escort when you're doing 500 knots and the helicopters are doing about 80 knots and they all of a sudden change direction like they can very rapidly on you, it poses some problems for fixed-wing aviation.
Would you discuss from your particular point of view the influence of weather on personnel, logistics, and so forth?
Yes, our particular squadron, as far as the weather and terrain was concerned, affecting personnel, we were of unanimous opinion that you required extremely good physical condition in all of Vietnam. The heat was, you were capable of withstanding the heat, but the humidity when it got high was extremely bad and made the situation entirely uncomfortable for you. In addition, we also, of course, found that flight clothing presently provided to Marine aviators and the normal utility clothing and boots are definitely not suited to this type of climate or terrain. The utilities are too heavy. We eliminated this problem, of course, by cutting off the sleeves on the utility jackets, and this made it somewhat easier to get around. The new lightweight utilities should have a lot to do with making life more bearable as far as operating on the job is concerned. I'd like to cover this clothing and equipment a little bit in more detail later on when I get into the intelligence aspect of escape and evasion and survival as far as aviators are concerned. We generally discovered that found that morale was exceptionally high. I think this was attributed due to the combat mission required of Marine aviation. The max number of sorties required every day, and you knew that, I think the ground troops, squadron ground personnel, knew that each mission that they assisted in getting airborne was going out to help somebody that needed help right then and there. And our troops consistently provided, out of the 15 aircraft that we had available, our average availability for the period we were in Vietnam was 13 out of the 15 a day, which, when you consider the complexity of the F-4B fire control system, was an outstanding achievement.
Did you encounter any unusual problems in the areas of personnel intelligence operations or logistics?
Yes, in logistics, I think it's a generally accepted and well-known fact that the aviation Class 5A stores are in critical supply, and I won't delve into that in any further detail. One of the big problems we did encounter, however, was an F-4B squadron with the multiple carriage MERS and turret racks can expend a tremendous amount of ordnance daily. This requires a beefing up of the squadron ordnance section in personnel to handle this capability, and in addition requires some means of loading these bombs onto the racks as they sit on the aircraft. The method that we used was manpower, and of course you can't manhandle too many 500-pound and 1,000-pound bombs without incurring injuries on your personnel. And in fact, our ordnance section had a high percentage in relation to the number of men involved of hernias and damaged hands from 500-pounder and 1,000-pound bombs being dropped and crushing hands and this sort of thing. A bomb loader was borrowed from the U.S. Air Force, an MJ-1 bomb loader. This is a mechanical bomb loader that can lift either bombs or rocket pods hydraulically onto a position on the Murator. And without this, we would have been in serious trouble as far as changing ordnance loads on a max number of airplanes or getting ordnance uploaded in a short amount of time. So a bomb loader of some type is a definite necessity. Now, the Marine Corps does have a SATS field bomb loader. However, the problem with this is that it's not good for rough terrain, and you only rate one per SATS site. So if you're operating out of a fixed base like Da Nang, you don't are not authorized a SATS bomb loader, and you've got to do it by manual or hand method. One of the other areas, or the most critical areas I think the squadron encountered, was the extreme shortage of maps, particularly in the 1 to 50,000 scale and the 1 to 250,000 scale, AGC, air-ground charts. I think it's really not too well known in the United States yet that aviators in Vietnam are using the 1 to 250,000 AGC series chart, which is a new air-to-ground chart with a much better terrain depiction on it for aviators in high-speed aircraft to pick out individual items of terrain. And the ground troops, of course, are using the 1 to 50 and the 1 to 250,000 AMS series, which is graduated in meters. The AGC series is graduated in feet. for the forward air controller or the company commander. This presents some problems that if he doesn't think about it and the aviator doesn't think to query any elevation or altitude that he gets from him, it could cause serious problems. But the maps themselves were in critical supply. Of course, all squadrons in the committed to contingency operations are required to have a map mount out readily packed and available to them, accessible to them. And we discovered that our mount-out packs of maps were being diverted on their way from storage in Japan, were being diverted to other units at Okinawa, and consequently never arrived to the aviation units in Da Nang in particular. And I speak specifically of MAG 16 and VMFA 531. We found also that because of the shortage of maps, we had to reuse many maps several times. The humidity... when you constantly fold and refold a map to get a specific area on it in the small confines of a cockpit, the humidity, the extreme humidity encountered in Vietnam causes the map to start shredding at the seams or the folds that you've got folded in the map. And this creates some problems. We normally got about five or six flights out of one particular map and then had to do, destroy the map. It became unusable. Another area was vehicles. The aviation surlist, multi-purpose vehicle for aviation units, we found was completely unsatisfactory in Vietnam. A high rate of deadline due to parts, transmissions breaking down with no spares available. The vehicle has a tendency in not even rough terrain, but just a slightly rough terrain of coming apart at the seams right behind the driver's cab of the truck. The whole frame and everything just cracks and breaks. Tremendous problem with parts and defective items on the surlist itself, particularly in the ignition and the wiring system. This vehicle could stand some real close scrutiny by the Marine Corps as far as improvements are concerned.
Do you have any observations on the equipment and weapons provided to your unit other than the trucks we just discussed?
Now, I'd like to, if I can, and just keeping my notes in line here, I'd like to go into the intelligence aspect right now and cover that a little bit as it relates to problem areas. One of the big things that we discovered, or I have discovered since being in the intelligence field, is that we have extremely limited personnel augmentation for squadrons, aviation squadrons, that are going to operate independently of the air groups. And a large percentage of our contingency plans call for independent squadron operations, and there appears to be no planning done, although I realize that there is an extreme shortage of intelligence-trained personnel. There doesn't appear to be too much consideration given to independent squadron operations and augmenting them intelligence-wise to carry out their mission. There is, as I've mentioned previously, a decided lack of qualified air intelligence officers, and I think an excessive rotation among intelligence billets. And I think the Marine Corps in the near future is going to have to look towards some subspecialization by aviation officers into this air intelligence field. It's an extremely technical field. If the individual is going to perform satisfactorily in combat, requires a vast amount of knowledge which can't be accumulated on short notice. This guy's got to be training for a long period of time, using the publications and documents that he'll use in combat, be thoroughly familiar with them, and be capable of conducting an adequate intelligence section. And the Marine Corps is going to have to look towards some sort of subspecialization in the O-200 field as far as air intelligence officers are concerned. In Vietnam itself, we found a distinct disadvantage in the fact that the Marine VMCJ squadron was committed, of course, elsewhere, and not able to provide Marine fixed-wing aircraft with pre- or post-strike photography of target areas. In the type of terrain you have in Vietnam, photography is of the utmost importance, even on local unit operations when you're providing an air patrol or airborne alert aircraft for a patrol action that's taking place. Photography is imperative. We also discovered that there is an inadequate supply of hardcover intelligence publications for squadrons that will be operating independent of their parent air groups. The minimum intelligence requirements list that are published by the PAC and the LANT levels give an allowance list of various publications for various units. Normally, a squadron operating with its air group would go to the air group if they wanted some particular document which they were not authorized to hold. And if the squadron then splits off from the parent air group and is expected to function a complete intelligence section, the group is not prepared with additional copies of these publications, either in a mound-out pack of some kind or a ready-issue pack to be given to the mound-out squadron, is not prepared to turn their publications loose because, of course, they have other squadrons to support. So we found this was an extreme problem, and we had to borrow from the Air Force in Japan, beg from the wing any extra available copies of publications that were required for squadron operations. A small but minor but very important problem was the allowance of safe storage allocated to an individual squadron. I can't recall what the exact number of safes authorized VMFA squadron is, but there are not enough safes to go around, particularly when you move out of a nice brick building with all the security features available into operating in the field with tents or in a hangar where you're conducting intelligence operations with other aircraft maintenance briefings, troop lounges, and this sort of thing. You've got to have an increased allowance of safes, and these should be accounted for and either held as your maps and your intelligence publications are in a ready mount-out status to be given to you when you mount out or deploy, or given to you on a permanent custody basis. This, again, the shortage of personnel, a lot of people don't appreciate that in the intelligence business, you have to operate an intelligence section 24 hours a day, 7 days a week when you're in combat. There's no time off to go get chow, no time off to get sleep. Somebody, a qualified individual, has got to be manning that intelligence section 24 hours a day. And here we again come up to this problem of a lack of qualified intelligence personnel. I also believe that combat operations by air units in Vietnam pointed up the requirement or the possible requirement to reconsider separating the intelligence section from the operations department in the tactical squadrons. As it's presently done, subordinated to the operations department, intelligence matters, which are vital and have been subordinated in peacetime training, now assume an urgent status and come to the fore in combat, and never before have the intelligence personnel been given the responsibility and the authority to conduct particularly training in peacetime endeavors, where everybody is clamoring for a slice of the training cake. And if he's subordinated to the operations department, he gets whatever the operations department wants him to have and not what he feels is necessary for the unit as far as intelligence training is concerned. So I think this should be reconsidered. And I think also we have an extreme problem with the low experience level of all intelligence personnel caused by this lack of interest in the training program during peacetime. Intelligence never seems to become too important until you're getting shot at, and then it's too late to start acquiring intelligence knowledge from the individual operating level. So I think this requirement to have an individual S2 department again in the squadron with a captain or senior first lieutenant as the S2 officer who can fight for training time and ensure that training is conducted within a unit is imperative.
Captain, what type of aircraft did you fly?
I was flying the F-4B Phantom, twin jet, twin seat aircraft.
What did you think of its capabilities, combat capabilities?
I thought its combat capabilities were outstanding. The only deficiency that we noted with the aircraft was the lack of a gun pod, and I think it's generally accepted by aviation units in Vietnam that the 20-millimeter cannon is the most useful all-round weapon you can have on an aircraft. Other than that, the aircraft with its dual capability of carrying its air-to-air intercept ordnance load plus a conventional ordnance load gives it an outstanding versatility in Vietnam.
How many missions did you fly, Captain?
I flew a total of 87 missions.
Would you give a brief description of a normal mission?
Yes. Let's take, for example, a ground alert mission, of which we stood many. You would be on a 15-minute alert status. A scramble would come in for some U.S. Marine or Special Forces or ARVN unit that was in trouble and required close air support immediately. As you raced out to the aircraft and cranked up, normally in sections of two, the intelligence section would crank in and start producing the maps, one for the pilot and one for the RIO of each aircraft. And by the time you'd gotten started up out on the flight line and were accepting your mission over the radio from the tower, the intelligence section would have the maps done up and at your aircraft. And as soon as you got those aboard, You took off out the taxiway and got armed from the ordnance crews, and then got airborne on a fastest possible type run to the target area. We normally utilized a forward air controller airborne, either Air Force or Marine, and positioned ourselves some 10 miles from his position after checking in with him on in the air on the way to the target to preclude the VC from finding out right away that we were on our way to the target. As soon as the forward air controller airborne was ready to receive us, we would acknowledge, tell him that we were headed in from the initial point and to go ahead and mark the target as soon as we had him visually. He would mark the target with a smoke rocket, stand off the target a couple hundred meters to one side of it, and as soon as that smoke rocket went off, the first aircraft was expected to be in his dive on the target, and the forward air controller would then correct his hits from that smoke rocket, and each succeeding pilot would be in the dive as the pilot ahead of him's ordnance went off on the target and would be corrected in distance and clock code by the forward air controller airborne. And we would run a, because of the limited or non-existence of enemy anti-aircraft fire in South Vietnam of the millimeter capacity, the flying was done on an extremely precision basis, everybody flying as accurate a path as they could without much thought to evasion because of the lack of AAA.
How about ground fire, small
Yes, we had a fairly good amount of ground fire, mostly 50 caliber automatic machine guns and small arms and automatic weapons, all of it using tracer. Of course, the 50 caliber was only effective against an aerial target up to about 4,500 feet, the small arms and automatic weapons up to about 1,500 feet, so they didn't pose too much of a problem to us. And in fact, if the gunner was using tracer, it provided a tremendous pinpoint to us of his position, and we just follow his tracers right on down and zap him.
As far as your missions in Vietnam in particular are concerned, is there anything peculiar to the Vietnam area and aircraft operations in combat?
Well, I think primarily the fact that there's an intense or a large amount of jungle in Vietnam, of course, and the pilot is not always able to see what damage he's doing, and in fact we don't get reports back sometimes from a ground agent that's sent into the area or a ground unit that's involved in combat. We don't get no reports back in the squadron for maybe 6 weeks or 2 months indicating what the damage was on a particular hop. A lot of times it's just a great big sea of green jungle and you're dropping bombs in it and you have the frustrating feeling that you're making toothpicks and matchsticks. But you know that underneath that jungle there are troops, VC and Vietnamese regulars, North Vietnamese regulars, and that occasionally we've had reports back of 160, 180 kVAs by air on one particular strikes, one of the particular strikes in that type terrain. So once you get over this frustration and not being able to see the big buildings blowing up and the troops dying in the open fields, it's definitely a self-satisfying feeling to know that you're doing an awful lot of good for the troops down there who have no other means of support other than air power. They can't get artillery into them.
So you'd say the coordination between ground and air then is excellent?
Tremendously so. I think the Marine Corps does have one problem in the patrol actions they run, that there are not enough forward air controllers to go around for each patrol. If I were an infantry commander, I would ensure that the officer taking that patrol out knew how to communicate on an air-ground radio and had an air-ground radio with every patrol they went off. There are alert aircraft available to all units in Vietnam, and if you get in a jam and you have no other supporting fire and you have a UHF capability or a radio capability to talk to air, get them in there and they'll work with you. If the aircraft cannot talk to you, they cannot give you good support. They've got to know where you are and where you want their ordnance put.
Are there any problems as far as staying on station and having targets available are concerned?
No, I understand right now, of course, that the targets are getting scarce and few and far between. But as far as on station time and a conventional ordnance load, we figured an hour and a half on station within a 100-mile radius of Da Nang. We could stay on station any length of time. And I think this was one of the big advantages of the forward air controller airborne. If you have run out of targets, the forward air controller airborne just decreases his altitude and gets right down on the terrain or the jungle or whatever the terrain is you're working in, and he'll fly around low and slow until some VC just gets cocky enough that he'll take a shot at him, and the forward air controller airborne can hear that round coming up towards him. He can pinpoint where it was delivered from, and right away he's got a target for you. So this was one of the good points of using the forward air control airborne. They're invaluable in terrain like Vietnam.
I understand, Captain, you have some aviation firsts.
Yes, we do. I think VMFA 531 scored several firsts for Marine aviation. The squadron was the first Marine squadron to use F-4Bs in combat. It was the first squadron to utilize F-4Bs, F-4B jets, in helicopter escort and landing zone preparation in combat. It was the first jet squadron in Vietnam to operate under night flares dropped by transport aircraft. And it was also the first squadron, jet squadron and Marine Corps squadron, to use the air support radar team in combat. And in fact, we utilized the air support radar team for the very first time in combat in Vietnam.
Thank you very much, Captain, for your interview.